Today we're very lucky to have Professor Danny Dorling, who's the professor, who's the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford. And I think it's fair to say you've been spending about 25 years working on the wealth gap and the geographies of wealth gap. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Danny. Danny's going to talk for about 40 minutes and there'll be time for questions at the end.
Thank you. This is a wide-ranging talk, so I apologise at the start. I'm going to be covering many, many different issues. It's based on two books. One's a book called Injustice, the second edition of which was published in June this year. And it was interesting putting together a second edition because that meant mainly updating all the statistics that I'd last done 5 years ago to see what had happened since 2010 when it comes to inequality. And as you can guess, it's all a bit depressing. So I'll give you some depressing facts and figures as we go through. And the second book is one called Order is Solid, about the situation of housing in Britain. Because for many people, simply being able to house yourself, being able to find somewhere to live, being able to pay the rent, or if you're lucky or privileged enough nowadays to be able to borrow a huge amount of money and get a mortgage, the angst that prices may collapse or that interest rates may rise. Housing has become the new kind of precarity. We're now finding that we're precariously housed before we found that we were precariously employed. And my worry or my idea about this is that this causes all kinds of stresses and strains in the society, which come out in all different kinds of ways, which are all incredibly hard to prove, because it's a series of correlations of things happening at the same time. The other impetus for doing this is just under 20 years ago, with David Gordon, George David Smith and Mary Shaw, we wrote a book called The Widening Gap, about health inequalities and how wide they had got in the 80s and 90s and the implications of that. As things seemed a bit simpler then, in that the gap had widened massively, the gap in people's incomes and life chances had widened, we'd had 18 years of conservative rule, it didn't seem like a very complicated picture to find out cause and effect, what it was which was leading to this, and then by implication what you might do about it. But since the end of that Conservative government, since 1997, we didn't see a remarkable turning around. We didn't see the poorest areas becoming better off. We didn't see the life expectancy gaps narrowing. For a very short period, for about 2 years after Tony Blair was elected, there was a dramatic fall in suicides, which I still want somebody to look at in detail. I think enough people really did believe that things can only get better. That, of course, as you probably know, has reversed, and we've had a rise in the last few years. The statistics coming out in the last few months are the beginnings of the really dramatic numbers that you would expect to see as a result of the cuts and austerity that we're getting. So the big rise in overdoses and heroin and so on are just beginning to be reported. We shouldn't necessarily expect to see these things, because in the past, when there were recessions, you often saw an improvement in health. The oldest one I know is the cotton famine, when the ships from the US, because of the Civil War, couldn't come to Liverpool and dock and they had to lay women off the mills, and infant mortality plummeted because you no longer needed to dose your baby up with morphine so they slept through the day when you went to work in the mill, because there was no work in the mills. More recently, in the 30s and even in the 1980s, when there were recessions, the jobs that went were often dangerous jobs. There were construction jobs, there were jobs to do with heavy industry, and the death rate actually fell when people were laid off. So recessions in the past have sometimes resulted in a narrowing of gaps, also particularly because the rich tended to lose out and become less rich. Things have been different since the late 80s and 90s. When there's been economically hard times, it seems to have hit those at the bottom more, and in ways that you never expected. So the thing that still shocks me the most is that since 2010, we've had a massive increase in families who are having to rent privately. By about 2015, one in four families with children in Britain were renting privately. It had shot up in less than a tenth just a few years ago. So one in four renting privately, with the rents going up, moving on average maybe once per year, with children having to move school again and again and again. You could never have predicted it. And it happened for a complicated set of reasons. I don't think it was a conspiracy. But what it means now in London is that with every year that passes in London, an extra 1% of the population find themselves private renting, led by families with children, because they are the poorest and they're also the ones who are routinely priced out by young people without children when the rents go up. These are issues that in the 90s we would not have thought we would be talking about. So I've written here, we've got a new kind of servant class in the southeast of England. To be a servant in the past, what was worse about being a servant 100 years ago was that you couldn't have children. If you lived in the house of the rich people, you lived in the basement or the attic, and you couldn't start a family. Now, if you take a job working in a primary school in my city of Oxford, your pay will just about pay for your rent and your food in the shared house, but you can't start a family again. And it's a question of what are the implications of that kind of thing. So I'll give you several examples of this going on. I'm assuming, because I'm at a medical sociology conference, that you're happy for me to say that there is incredible rates of social polarisation going on at the moment. The very rich are getting richer, the poor are getting absolutely poorer, and we can debate this if you want to, but I'm not going to bother arguing it with you, because I assume you generally agree with me that it's obvious that that is happening. We know in the last 2.5 years we've seen an absolute rise in deaths amongst elderly women. Public Health England may still be investigating it. They were investigating it. The investigation appears to have stopped sometime around May this year, or at least slowed down. And we're politically in an era since the election where these things appear not to matter very much. I wrote an article in the New Statesman about the rise in mortality amongst elderly women. These are women aged 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, dying 2 or 3 years earlier than you'd expect. They are exactly the age group that Harold Shipman targeted. But here you're talking 30, 40,000 women across the country. I came up with at least 10 possible reasons as to why we could be having this absolute rise. We're now seeing it in the life expectancy figures dropping for women over age 65. But the crucial thing about elderly women as opposed to elderly men is that elderly women tend to be on their own much more often, so are in a much weaker position when you have cuts, when you stop the visits to people's houses. The visits may have been fairly pointless for many reasons, the 15-minute visits and you make a cup of tea and you go again, but they were very good ways of finding somebody lying at the bottom of the stairs still breathing. And if those visits stop, you can see a problem. But there are possibly more complicated things that are impossible to prove. We had a dramatic fall in our carbon pollution in 2008-09. 10% drop in the amount we were polluting the planet. Sounds like great news. Because the price of petrol went up and people's incomes went down. So people drove less. But what journey do you choose not to take if you're going to drive less? And I suggest it was that annual visit to the great aunt you hardly knew at all. So I suspect that the elderly were left on their own much more often than they had been before. I do not believe it is the sudden effect of rising smoking in the 1970s amongst women suddenly hitting then. It doesn't make any sense that that's the case. But we have life expectancy falls. The last time we saw life expectancy falls was in the 1930s after particular pit disasters along with mass unemployment. We have absolute rises in poverty. We have soup kitchens again. And again, if we're writing the 1990s, I don't think we would have predicted that we would be getting soup kitchens. It's very hard to measure anxiety and depression, but there are ways of doing it, and they suggest that things are not good, particularly not good for young people, because the young are looking at a very precarious future where they're told they have to compete at an incredible rate. They're examined every year. You have to get into university. That is your only future. So the majority of young women in Britain now go to university, but then you have to somehow find a way of funding a master's course. And if you're lucky, you'll get that temporary job. But will you ever manage to find somebody and settle down and stay in the same place? I can see reasons why anxiety should be rising, because there are reasons to be anxious for a cohort. Talking therapies are a lot less useful if they're trying to convince you that what you're worried about isn't real, if what you're worrying about is partly real. But far too many questions. You're going to start seeing lots of graphs like this little one. This is the fall in years of life lost. I think it comes out in a government report soon. I get sent loads of these things at the moment that are not yet out. And the amazing thing about them is that they have names redacted. I can't believe that parts of the NHS and Public Health England are producing internal documents with that black redaction thing that you normally only see MI5 and MI6 do. But I do worry that people high up know that there are problems, and that there will come a time when this period is looked back again, and people will ask, why were the authorities not blowing the whistle and saying that the elderly are rather like the canary in the mine? When the elderly begin to die a bit earlier, you can tell things are going wrong. It correlates with pension credits being cut. When you see rises in suicide amongst the young, you can tell things are going wrong. I think people monitoring these numbers, of which of course there are far fewer now than there used to be, are aware that something quite dramatic is happening. The politics of it. If you listen to the budget in, when was the budget? Was it June? It was June of this year. There's an official transcript to the budget, but then the Chancellor, because he has a degree in history, not a particularly good degree in history, but he has a degree in history, decided to add this little bit to the end of his budget speech, which I think shows his thinking. I think he honestly believes this. And there is a belief amongst those who are currently leading us that they come from a stock who did great things in the past and will do great things in the future, and those who really don't keep up, kind of deserve themselves. It was the Conservatives who first protected working people in the mills. Each one of these sentences is strictly true. It was the Conservatives who took a great step forward towards state education. It was the Conservatives who introduced equal votes for women. It was the Conservatives who gave people the right to buy. So of course it is now the Conservatives who are transforming welfare and introducing a national living wage, which will be maybe £9 an hour, but of course much less than that once you've lost your credits. This is the party for the working people of Britain. And I think you have a kind of toxic mix. If you have that message being told from the top, it's a bit like the Black Welfare Queen message that Reagan told in the 1980s. You know, we are actually your salvation. We're the working people's salvation, and if things are going wrong for you, it is your own fault. Contrast this with the situation after the last major financial banking crash, which was 1929. I mean, this was written remarkably soon. This was 1930 from John Maynard Keynes. We are suffering now from a bad attack of economic pessimism. It's common to hear people say the epoch of enormous economic progress, which characterised the 19th century, is over, that the rapid improvement in the standard of life is now going to slow down. You hear that again now, we're going to get obese, we shouldn't expect our children to live as long as us. At any rate, in Great Britain, that a decline in prosperity is more likely than an improvement in the decade which lies ahead of us. Keynes and his friends, that little group around Bloomsbury, who had very exciting lives, didn't just produce new economic theories. What they did, and this was according to Oswald Foulkes, who was a banker, but also Keynes's friends, is they helped codify a new moral sentiment, a new moral feeling of the age, that what had happened before was wrong. What had to happen was something new, you couldn't return to business as normal, which they tried to do in 1930, 31, 32 and 33, until we got the New Deal in the States, when you finally got a new president elected. You had to run society along different lines. You couldn't accept what you were currently living with. I think at the moment, we're largely currently accepting what we're living with, but we may be beginning to get a greater degree of resistance in a similar way that we got in the 1930s before, which is this argument that says it is wrong, it has been wrong for some time, and it needs to change. I'm going to spend about 10 minutes talking to you about income inequality now, because I'm obsessed with these numbers. So you can tell me later whether it's become less obsessed, but I think these things really matter. There are two lines in this graph. The top line is the income take of the best off 1% before tax, and the bottom line is the take of the 1% after tax. In the 1920s, like every other rich country in the world, Britain was incredibly unequal. The richest 1% got 20% of all income. It was an upstairs, downstairs world. And that got better and better and better, if you think that degree of inequality was wrong, until you get to the heady days of the late 1970s, where the best off 1% were only taking 6% of all income. That means earning six times the average wage. That means top bankers on about 120,000 a year, rather than 2 million. And after tax, it gets even better. After tax, only 4%. So only getting four times the average wage, about 80,000. The moral sentiment has been changed, probably before Keynes was even talking. And so this decline in inequality was possible. The moral sentiment was changed again in the 1970s. And I'm very happy to endlessly dwell about why that might have been and how it came about and why it came about in the USA and Britain and not elsewhere in Europe. And inequality then rose and rose. You cannot see that Labour government. In fact, you can't see hardly any governments here. It doesn't really matter which party's in power. The whole thing swings one way and the whole thing swings the other way. Until you get to now, and now we're back to kind of 1930s levels of inequality again. And you're kind of told that this is just inevitable. This is the way the world's going. The world is all becoming more unequal. I'm going to show you this, some data now from 5 years ago, and then I'll update it for you. So these are the best figures we can get from the United Nations about inequality in the richest 25 countries in the world. This is the ratio of the income of the best tenth of the population to the poorest for more than tenth of the population. The most equal country in the world about 5 years ago was Japan, where the best off 10th were getting 4.5 times more than the poorest 10th. That's the best it gets. After that, you've got the Scandinavian countries, Finland, Norway and Sweden, all very nicely lined up. Germany, Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, and then Switzerland. And I'm only showing you the bottom third of this table. So these are the more equal countries. Switzerland is actually a dramatically equal country. The 1% in Switzerland take half as much as the 1% in Britain. Bankers in Switzerland are paid half as much as bankers here. If we go forward, we get to France, the Netherlands, which is the middle country in Europe, Ireland, Canada, Greece, where the best off 10th have every year 10 times more money to spend than the worst off 10th. It's driven by the top 1%, but that also pushes up the money of the top 2%, 3%. The gaps between the median families in these groups will be much narrower. But I think the take of the 1% really matters. And then up to Spain, Italy, and finally we get into New Zealand, Australia, and Israel, where in Israel the best off 10th had an income 13 times higher than the poorest 10th. And Israel's a very divided society. You can perhaps see how that's possible. But if we go forward again, if I press the right button, then we get to the most unequal countries in the rich world, which was the United Kingdom, for the best off 10th, have 14 times more. Portugal, which was slightly more unequal than Britain, but isn't now since the crash, because who had all the income in Portugal? It was the better off. What's happened to Portugal? Everybody's lost out. What's happened to the poor in Portugal? They were already extremely poor, so they couldn't drop much more. Then the United States, which we compare ourselves with far too much, and then Singapore. People treat other people differently when you have different degrees of inequality in a country. You can see it in everything. You can see it in the tips you're expected to pay. Or whether you're expected to pay a tip at all. You don't pay tips in restaurants in Japan. You don't even pay tips in Greece. But we pay tips here. What's it around about now? 15%? I expect it's gone up. It's 20% in the US. There's all kinds of differences in social relations in different countries. There are lots of ways in which people are made to feel small, other people are made to feel big, that you take for granted, that you often don't even notice. If you've been watching the news for the last 4 or 5 months, you might have noticed that the story I've told you is very different from the story David Cameron's been saying. David Cameron's been saying inequality has fallen. And even The Economist, they had a nice called Statistical Tricks about it. He's referring to the blue line. The blue line is the ratio of the lowest paid person out of that top 10% and the best paid person out of that bottom 10%. So it's ignoring the vast majority of the top 10th. The Institute for Fiscal Studies showed a couple of years ago that among the bottom 99% of people in Britain, inequality has fallen. It's the 1% who've moved away. That's where all the growth in inequality has been. People earning over £160,000-£200,000 a year. So if you say, just forget about the top 1%, you can then say, oh look, we're a country coming together again. We've taken away the child benefit from people at the top. You know, we haven't yet completely cut the incomes at the bottom. There's more cohesion. We really are all in it together. And the 1%, they're different. They're special. They're job creators. They're people who run, you know, big advertising industries around the world. Just ignore them. And it's all okay. And the question is whether you can do that. I'm afraid this table is far too small, but this is my best attempt to update it from the figures from last year. And it shows the US is now at the top. Singapore is dropping down its place. Singapore has brought in capital control since the crash to stop overseas buyers coming in and buying flats at inflated prices in Singapore, because they thought bad things might happen if they allowed that to occur. So Singapore is currently on a slightly downward trajectory. Israel's managed to jump the same as us. We've jumped over Portugal, so we're still fourth or third. And it's similar as you go lower down. I've taken out four countries here for which we've got data at 2 points in time. This is extremely dodgy, but I'm afraid this is as good as the international statistics get. And just taking the straight line projection of what happens if the change in the last 5 years is to continue. And the key thing is that the United States carries on being the most unequal country to 2020. And then we draw level pegging with it in 2025. And then we overtake it in 2030. So we're currently on course to become the economically most unequal country in the rich world of the 25 largest richest countries. This is brilliant news for medical sociology, because you are working in the place to study if you want to know what is the effects of high and rising inequality. There's nowhere better in the world to go to see, does it matter? Does it have an implication? Does it not matter than where we are? Obama did manage to bring in tax rises for the rich. They were relatively small, but they're actual rises. So the US is beginning to become slightly more equal. We're doing the opposite. We had corporation tax of 28% in 2010. It's now down to 20%. That's a massive drop. Corporation tax is only paid by very rich people. It's going down to 18% very soon. We've had very rapid tax drops for the very wealthy. That shows you how dodgy this is. 2 points, that's all I've got. But that's it, that's where we're heading on the data that we have. So we're going to win the global race. We're going to become the most unequal country in the rich world. And it's an enormous shift if we carry on in this direction. It's huge, going from 13 times to 24 times. It's almost certainly not going to happen. Whenever you're at an extreme you project forward, that almost never happens. My favourite example of this is, there's a book that Peter Townsend wrote with colleagues years ago about health inequalities. His name forgets me. The Black Report. In the back of the Black Report, they had a list of 10 areas with the worst health in Britain. And it said, if we don't do something about this now, things will not get better in those 10 areas. They didn't do anything about it. In fact, things got much worse in those 10 areas. Unemployment rose dramatically afterwards. The Conservative government did nothing. And five of those 10 areas, if you looked, actually went up. They went up because the only way they could go is up, and other things were happening. So I wouldn't be completely depressed about the position of Britain. I think we're just looking at it at a very strange point. Although, of course, somewhere is going to have to be the most unequal rich country in the rich world. You can paint a dystopian future for the UK. You can say that it makes sense, economic sense, to have a policy of trickle-down in one country. Okay, trickle-down doesn't work generally, but it could work in just one place. Make one place low tax. Try and get all the billionaires of the world to come in rather than just half of them and buy your property. Provide them servants. Give them good private schools for their kids, a high degree of security. The most common job type in Knightsbridge, I learnt today at another conference earlier, is to work in security. So of the residents of Knightsbridge, more people are working in security than work as bankers. We could provide them places for their youngsters to study master's courses in our universities at fees of £20,000 or £25,000 a year. We might already be beginning to do that kind of thing. So you could have an economic plan to have a high degree of inequality in one country. Correlations. This is just the latest information from WHO. You might say, well, they're incredibly low compared to what they were a few decades ago. But you're looking at rates, well, more than double between Finland, Japan, Sweden, compared to the United States. And a connection between a high degree of inequality and hence a high degree of poverty. And your infants doing far worse is very, very strong. The outliers are all relatively easily explainable. There are not many of them. Singapore is my favourite outlier. The country with the lowest infant mortality rate in the world that didn't want to boast about it. And you had to ask, why, if you had the lowest infant mortality in the world, wouldn't you want to tell people what a wonderful health service you've got? Singapore does have a wonderful health service, but it also has a policy of pregnancy testing all 100,000 maids every 3 months and deporting them if they're pregnant. And so if you deport your poor while they're pregnant so they can't have their child in your country, then your infant mortality rate will be lower. Not so much because they don't have their baby outside and die, but because they simply try very, very, very hard not to become pregnant in the first place. So the outliers are interesting on these things. But things change. I put up this thing about corporal punishment because I think we forget how quickly things can get better. When I was at school, we got caned in a state school. So if you just think how fast we went from that being seen as normal, it lasted for longer, by the way, if you're in private schools. They managed to keep it for longer, lucky people. I think you can be optimistic about all kinds of things by taking a series of examples. Just because something happens to happen now, doesn't mean that within a very short amount of time it cannot be seen as abhorrent. Apologies for these complicated graphs, I won't say much about them. But they kind of explain my feeling. I'll say a little bit about this one. This one is from a study, which was a study of anxiety and depression in many countries. There's a chance that one of the authors might be here, so I do apologise about what I've done with your study. The study concluded that there was no rise in anxiety and depression amongst 15-year-old girls. What I've done here is I took out all the countries that were not North America to see what happens if you just put in North America, and you get a correlation which is significant, and even more if you add on the most recent study at the end. What has happened in the original study is they included studies from Japan and studies from places like Western Europe and so on, which tended to come in later in the 2000s and the late 90s, and there's much lower levels of anxiety in these more equal countries amongst young people, possibly because you're more likely to have a settled, less precarious life if you grow up in one of these countries, and you might know it by looking forward, whereas in the US you might make it, but odds on you won't make it. The median family have seen their incomes dropping for 30 years in the US. That's part of the sign of things going wrong in some places. This data is from Scotland, Ben Goldacre wrote something in The Guardian a few years ago saying you should be careful with this data, but I do think it's pretty telling. It's the uptake of Prozac and other selective serotonin inhibitors to well over, even if you've got some people taking very high doses, it's more than 1 in 10 of the population. Now taking themselves mentally away from the problem or the issue. And the studies I've seen internationally of this show that the rates at which people are medicating in this way are higher where things are more unequal in the rich world. And fascinating, you can only get detailed data in the States, but they're highest in places like Los Angeles, and they're highest of all in Beverly Hills. So the wealthy are not sitting there happily going, we're okay. They're actually popping more pills than the average person in these places. But reasons to be optimistic is geography. I'm a geographer. And just these huge geographical differences between different countries in behaviour. So whenever you hear somebody say it's a global trend, they're almost always talking complete rubbish. Almost always. This is the rate. There's no reason why this correlates with this. It could correlate with many other things, but it's the connection between the take of the best off 1%, going up to over 20% of all income in the United States, and the proportion of people who cycle or walk to work, which is highest in the Netherlands. And you might think, how can those two things be correlated? How does it make sense? Do people in the Netherlands wake up one morning and go, hey, we live in a fairly equal society, let's get on the bike? and that isn't what's happening. If you look at other health-related behaviour, so smoking or drinking, you'll find no correlation between smoking and drinking and inequality. Smoking and drinking is quite high in Japan. I think it's because you can just choose to smoke or drink kind of on your own. You can try and control it. In Japan, you actually have to have a special card to allow you to buy cigarettes from shops. It's very annoying if you're a foreigner and don't know about this. But in general, you can find ways to smoke and drink if you want to smoke and drink in societies. You cannot find a way to walk or cycle to work just on your own if you live in the United States, because your workplace will be too far away. You cannot go out and build your own pavement. It may sound slightly ridiculous to talk about pavement, but there was a mayor in Texas a few years ago who, when it was proposed to build some pavements in this town in Texas, said that pavements were the beginning of the rocky road to communism. You can only get that kind of attitude in a very unequal country. You can only get attitudes of solidarity in more equal countries. You can't go out and paint your own cycle path. You can't create a good public transport system by yourself. What seems to be happening is that there are all kinds of correlations, but in general, better organised societies make the trains run on time better, but also control their rich better. You don't let your greediest 1% of the population take more and more and more. You organise yourself in the knowledge that there will always be greedy people. They might even be useful. They might be innovative. They might invent new things. That's fine. You don't want to stop them entirely being greedy. But if you don't do anything about it, they will take more and more and more. And the same kind of thinking that says you should do this also takes lead out of petrol earlier in places. Also designs towns. Thinks it's okay to design a town. You don't just let people build wherever they want individually. Otherwise you end up with urban sprawl and 20-mile commutes to work. So I'm not saying that this causes that. I'm saying there's something else going on that causes both things to be similar. And we need to learn from the difference. This is my favourite graph. So I promise not to explain any other graphs in any detail, because I know I'm coming to the end of my 45 minutes. But this graph fascinates me. It's a segregation index. So it's the proportion of Conservative voters that you would have to move between parliamentary constituencies if you had a magic voter butter knife and you could move it across Britain to get an even proportion everywhere. So it's the same as people do segregation indexes for people who are black or white and so on. It's a segregation index for Tories. way back in the election of 1918, you'd have had to have taken a fifth of Conservative voters, just the right fifth, and moved them from areas where more people voted Conservative than average towards areas where less people voted, and you could have spread the Conservative voters out absolutely evenly. So we were a very polarised country in 1918. Polarised in different ways. Protestant areas voted more Conservative. Lots of Conservative voting in Scotland. That political polarisation dropped and dropped and dropped. So places became more like each other. Constituency in York, York used to have one parliamentary constituency, becomes more like a constituency in Oxford, becomes more like a constituency in Wales. You get Conservatives everywhere, and you don't get a great bunching of Conservatives in particular places. Not particularly useful for winning elections, right through to the 1970s. Then you get this amazing little jump in 1974 when the southeast of England voted Tory, but not enough to win the election. Kind of relaxed down to 79, and then polarisation goes up and up and up and up to 2010, at which point I stupidly said, it looks really hard for the Conservatives to win another election, because with every election that passes, their vote is rising faster in the areas in which they already have the MP, and is disappearing in places where they don't have the MP, like Scotland, and then the marginal places in between. It's really, really tricky, but you do not want to be stacking up more and more votes in the places that you're most popular. And then lo and behold, they're going to do it again. They just do it. We have the biggest ever increase in political polarisation to the election of 2015. This has nothing to do with Scotland, because this is the Conservative Party and they don't exist in Scotland. So this is all about movements and changes in England and Wales. And they did become more popular in the seats they already held, but they won those Liberal seats in just the right places. They just won Nuneaton. It was almost perfect. They, from the point of view of a natural experiment in what happens, what you've got, only one in four people voted Conservative in the UK. One in four electors, about a third of people who voted, only one in four. So one in four people managed to vote in a government. I don't think there's anywhere else in the world this has ever happened. The best I've ever seen you get is the United States, where about 52% of people vote, massive abstentions in the US, but the president needs at least 26 or 27% of the electorate to win. I think we are now the most undemocratic, democratically elected country in the world, which is again interesting to look at. So this is an odd place. This little pie chart just shows you data from the 1980s, 90s and early noughties about how many people said they were finding things very difficult or they're just coping. Right? It wasn't that we were living in a land of milk and honey before 2007. I'd let you read that if you're getting bored. I won't read it out for you about what John Maynard Keynes said in the 1930s. But of course, you're beginning to hear people talk again about how this is just wrong. And I think part of the reason you're getting this talk at the same time as you're getting that statement from George Osborne in his budget about how it's really the Conservatives who are the party of working people is that our political opinions are actually polarising. So we are splitting apart as a population in what one group believes is right and true and what another group believes is right and true. And part of the reason that we can split apart as a population so widely is because we're not mixing with each other as much anymore to moderate our views. I, for 10 years, lived in Sheffield, so I never met an out Tory. There were some, I knew, but I never met a Tory who'd come out of the closet in Sheffield. We had not a single Conservative councillor. I now live in Oxford, and if I go 5 miles from my house in any direction, I know the vast majority of people I meet will have voted Conservative, because we are in a sea of blue. And there'll be people who do not meet people who vote Labour. And you can see in that context how your views can shift without you thinking your views have shifted, because you're just becoming more like the people around you. And the people around you think that things are just about okay, but it's kind of going downhill, and it'd all be okay if we stopped the immigrants coming in, because they're terrible, and that's why there aren't enough jobs. Or the people around you think the problem is the bosses are just greedy, and want to take more, and we shouldn't let landlords charge people as much as they want, and that's a normal attitude to have. I think we should recognise that we are probably living in a very remarkable and very strange time, and we shouldn't get too depressed about it, because whenever this has happened in the past, things have tended to change quite quickly, but you can't take it for granted that it will necessarily change in one direction, but it is much more likely that we will become more equal than more unequal, simply based on the probabilities of where you are at one extreme or the other extreme. And the really important thing to say, this is mortgage lending in the United States. Something absolutely massive happened in 2008. Absolutely huge, and we simply haven't adjusted to the fact that our financial system failed and hasn't corrected itself. We had a Ponzi scheme working for about 30 years and it no longer works and it no longer operates. And people had the same problem in 1929, 1930, 31, 32. The old and the middle aged thought we were going to return to where we were before. The young didn't. The young were then made to go and fight in a war, which particularly annoyed them. They were particularly annoyed because their parents had fought in a war, so there really was no excuse for making them go and fight in another war. And when they got power in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, they changed society and they created schools that everybody went to, and they made a National Health Service and so on. Because we particularly hurt the young as a result of that recession. So who are we particularly hurting at the moment? Who isn't getting the jobs? Who's having to get the temporary jobs? Who cannot even get housing benefit? Who's got no chance of getting a mortgage? Who can't start a family? Who's going to have a student debt of £56,000 a year? Who's likely to get a little bit pissed off in the near future? That's why I think you can be a bit optimistic about what's going to happen and what's going to change. This graph comes from ONS data. There's nowhere else in the rich world where the best off 1% have just so much wealth. And the nice thing about the wealth in Britain is, unless you're very good at taking the bricks down one by one and moving them from Mayfair somewhere else, you can't take it out of the country. And the reason why your property in Mayfair is worth so much is because it's in Mayfair. There are differences between different countries. We are extreme and highly abnormal. Our country feels normal to us because we live and we work in it and we're used to it. We don't treat it as odd, but we really should treat it as strange. We have warnings. This is the student debt bubble in the USA. It's not as if people don't know what happens if you do start to do the kind of things that we're doing. And I think out of this, you could possibly get a great improvement in the future, in 10 or 15 years' time, depending on the degree of agitation you have and the degree to which people are not willing to put up with it. You cannot predict what's happening in the future. There is no way that Keynes could have predicted in the 1930s that what would actually happen would be a world war. And during that world war, children would never have been better fed because of rationing. Infant mortality rates would never have dropped so low, and afterwards what would have happened? With luck, we're not going to get a world war again, but we're very likely to get another financial crisis again. And the question is, how do you plan to deal with that? Are you going to deal with it by trying to cut people from the bottom more when there's nothing more to cut? Are you going to try to increase student fees up to £10,000, £11,000, £16,000 when all the models show that there's no way the money can be repaid back in the future? Or are you going to begin to cut your cloth to what you actually have and say you really can't afford to have 1% of people taking 15% of all income every year, the group just beneath them taking a slice that's related to that, the group just beneath them taking a similar slice, and having the majority of the population living on much less? The average median family in France has a household income which is €10,000 higher than the median family in Britain. I've got a horrible feeling that the median family in Britain doesn't know what a median is, which allows you to get away with this con that supposedly things are worse in France And finally, you want 10,000 euros less if you're in the middle in Britain. That's before you take into account how much it costs to house yourself in this country. But as long as people in this country think it's like this everywhere else, maybe you can fool them into accepting it a little bit longer. But when you monitor their health, you monitor their levels of anxiety, you look at the drugs they're taking and what's happening to them, whether they're eating to make themselves feel better, and you compare that to the rate at which people do these things in other countries, I think you just begin to get to the conclusion that this is a very, very odd European country at a very, very odd time in its history, and it's not sustainable and it's going to change. And we need to start studying it from that kind of perspective and counting what's happening and making comparisons with other places. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Danny. So we've got time for quite a few questions if people want to. So. Could you say your name first as well?
Ian Rees Jones, Cardiff University. Thank you very much, Danny. That was brilliant. So this is a kind of friendly comment.
Yeah.
It's related to your last discussion of assets and houses being fixed where they are. But I would say they're registered in the Cayman Islands. It's, you know, recent online maps, my private eye show how that's grown, where it's concentrated in the UK. So it's really a question about focus on income inequality and whether, because you very elegantly described this change, unexpected change from the 90s onwards, which many of us didn't expect, and whether that's related to the ways in which assets have been controlled through different financial mechanisms now. And obviously that's much more difficult to show rather than on an income inequality graph, and correlations are clearer. But whether we should be looking at those kind of mechanisms that are related to the ways in which capital is able to move and be protected by certain groups, and the implications of that for the ways in which societies are organised.
Yeah. Okay. The data on wealth is more hidden and harder. There has been a lovely paper by, I think it's Nelson, I forgot, who looks at wealth inequalities and find correlations with mortality, both life expectancy and infant mortality. And interestingly, helps explain Denmark, which is always confused as very high income equality in Denmark, but high rates of smoking, not particularly good health, really high wealth inequality. So wealth inequalities can make a negative difference, but there are other countries in Scandinavia with high wealth inequalities where people seem to do fine. And I think it's about the trajectory. If you know your country is becoming more equal, and that is shown by the differences in income, then moving away from a legacy of wealth differences is less problematic. I looked up the private eye map and found that the nearest Bahamas house to me is two streets away, and it's a three-bed terrace house. The overseas property, I think, politically is less of a problem because, the person probably lives in Britain who's secretly put it through the Cayman Islands, and they've almost certainly broken the law in what they're doing. It's a tax dodge. But if they generally do live in the Cayman Islands, they don't have a vote. So they don't know if they've been fooled enough to buy property in this country without any power. You could have a sneaky idea of, let's let all the Russians and the Chinese and Saudis come in and buy all this stuff in London, and then we can tax them. The thing to do with that three-bed terraced house near me is simply to bring in normal European laws about the rights of tenants. So it doesn't matter who owns the house. When you rent it out, you've got to let people stay in it for a decent length of time. You can't increase the rent. And that would actually put people off wanting to be investors and landlords. And then you also council tax it at twice the normal rate if it's vacant, which is what Islington and Camden have been doing. So there are ways of dealing with that. our problem is people who think that they're rich. So this will be few of you, but more of your parents, who think their house is worth 600 or 800,000 or £1 million. One lovely thing to look at for mortality data, if we know the number of people who've died in each area, we also get the number of people who've paid inheritance tax in each area. Nationally, it's now down to about 2.5% of people who actually pay inheritance tax. The highest rate's in Kensington at 17%. Used to be 7%, but they changed the rules about... Anyway, hardly anybody pays inheritance tax because hardly anybody dies rich. You end up spending the money in your old age. You don't actually have the wealth. All these houses that people think are worth this much cannot be sold because the next generation of buyers, if they've been successful, have gone to university. If they've got a well-paid job, that means £26,000 a year, by the way, as opposed to £21,000. If they've got a well-paid job, they're looking at £70,000 or £80,000 student fee to pay back. And that comes directly off their potential mortgage. And that happens when they're age 31 in about 10 years' time from now. So the money's not there. Unless we go for the nightmare scenario of all the buyers are landlords and investors. And we head rapidly back to the 1920s and 1910 and a 90% renting society. And how are you going to do that? How do you send half your young women to university, teach all the people these things, and then tell the population, oh, you're all going to have to rent for the rest of your life? Renting's not necessarily bad, but you're going to have to rent with tenancy agreements that mean you can be chucked out with 2 months' notice, with the highest rents in Europe and the smallest, lowest quality property in Western Europe. I mean, unless we've been made really stupid, there comes a point. My sort of more subtle argument about this is forget about 90% of the population. Just worry about the top 10% of the population. The top 10% of the population had an income of about 2.5 times the national average in 79. Forgetting the 1%. By the time Margaret Thatcher left office, they had an income of 3 times the national average. So the Thatcher government rewarded the people just beneath the 1%, a big chunk of them, as well as the 1%. You can run a country if you look after the top 10%. You've only got to fool another 20% of people into believing that they can be haves. So you have the haves, the might haves, and then you have the have nots, half of whom don't vote. Since 2008, that 1% and the group beneath them have diverged rapidly. So you're now going to have to fool 99% of people. And I think you could kind of fool 90%, but I don't think you can possibly fool 99%. But maybe, I mean, maybe we've become so competitive that people do really believe that if you work hard, you can be up there. And we're becoming like the US, where a quarter of the population believe they're going to be in the 1%. Which requires a special degree of enumeracy to see. You can see people are optimistic. We see when parents vote for grammar schools. You know, you'd get a majority of parents voting for, in primary schools, voting for grammar schools, believing their children would be in the fifth who'd get in. But I don't buy... I don't think this is about being particularly left-wing or not. I think... if you're a selfish person who happens to be earning less than £160,000 a year, this is not in your interest anymore. And that's what's new. But we are a strange country.
Can I just ask, I went to summer school at UCL 4 years ago, led by Michael Marmot on the social determinants of health. And he had more or less the same, well, message, that is, you know, back for society as a whole to have wealth inequalities. You're more or less same. Why is it? It's because he was lobbying with you know, the government, etc. Why is it so hard to sort of get the message across in a way that it, you know, it's actually acted upon?
Yeah, why is it difficult to do?
In general,
I think it is recognising these as very long-term shifts. So, let's put it the other way. Supposing you were, I don't know, somebody called Hayek in the 1930s, Friedrich Hayek, and you believed that acting collectively was the road to serfdom and we really didn't need government to be doing things. And you were writing books in the 40s saying how bad this was and so on. You'd be like a voice in the wilderness. You know, people were getting a health service for the first time, they were getting free secondary education. Then they got rid of the 11 plus and it got even better. Then you got heart transplant surgery and so on. And there you are talking about how terrible it is to do things collectively. And you're speaking in the wrong time against the wrong wave. And I think for Michael Marmot's kind of message and the message of people around him, the message of, that was more radical than his, they were up against a wave which was saying people need more choice. Choice is good. You need a market in education. You need parents to be able to choose between schools. Why would you not let them choose between schools? We need universities to take any number of students. Why would you limit York University to take a fixed number? That's almost Stalinist. So there was a rhetoric of increased choice and increased freedom, which we don't even notice because we've become so used to it. And then somebody pops up and says about downstream and upstream forces, and here's a vague connection between a ratio and something else happening. And it just doesn't gel. Whereas if you look at something much more simple, which affects everybody, how do you house yourself? And if you can house yourself okay, do you think if you've got children or nieces and nephews, they will be able to house themselves okay? It's much easier to go, oh no, it's really hard to house ourselves. And then you say, well, what's happened? Has it suddenly become very hard to build a house? Have we had an earthquake and lots of the houses fallen down? We've actually built another 10 million bedrooms in the last 10 years between censuses. We've never had more rooms per person than we have now. So we have a housing crisis and we've never had as much housing. The amount of empty housing in London's rising. Not just empty whole flats, but rooms not being used by single people living in maisonettes that used to house a family. So what I'm saying is, the Michael Marmot way of doing it, and in many ways mine, of you know, look at this interesting connection between the ratio and this, doesn't work. The how much rent are you paying? You know, how much did you pay for that house? If you did manage to get a mortgage, is your mortgage bigger than the mortgage of all your siblings and parents all put together? And that's a debt, and even on interest rates as low as they are now, you've still got to pay twice that back. And who's getting that money? So I think maybe part of the problem is we didn't, or we haven't yet made it about everyday things. And housing is everyday for everybody. Just in the 80s, people tried to do it with unemployment. So in the 80s, it's terrible. We've got freemen unemployed, this is awful. What we discovered in the elections in the 80s is that the unemployed changed how they voted, and people related to the unemployed wouldn't vote Conservative. But for the bulk of the population, it was kind of, I'm all right, Jack, it's not me, it must be their fault. Housing really matters because you've all got to house yourself. And if you're managing to house yourself comfortably, you know it's partly chance. You happen to buy at the right time in the past, or you're lucky enough you're in a housing association property and they haven't yet changed the rules to chuck you out because you're not a deserving enough case, which they're doing in council housing. You know, you get yourself a job in a council house in London, it's time to leave. Your tenancy can be ended.
Isn't the sort of housing prices going through the roof good news for many people it's bad news for? Because for everyone who buys a house, they're hugely, say, like, if you buy a house in York today, it's going to cost you a fortune. But someone selling that house.
Yeah.
Isn't that the problem? When you say that, you know, for everyone who's earning less than £160,000 a year, you know, that the system's bad news, but it's not if your house price is going to be low necessarily, is it?
Oh, I think it's even better than that. I mean, it's not that they're going up, they're going up even more. So the entire stock is worth £4 trillion. It's absolutely enormous. It's a massive, massive windfall. You know, this is an incredibly huge amount of money that my mum and dad have. I don't have because I have a massive mortgage. So, you know, my mum and dad, in theory, have this windfall. Your parents have this windfall, and so on. It looks great. You can sell it. It's brilliant. The last place on earth which had a house price rise as big as ours and had the most expensive property in the world was Tokyo in the late 1980s. They were a fortune. The Imperial Palace, have you ever been to Tokyo? It's quite large, but the gardens of the Imperial Palace in about 1989 were valued at being worth more than the whole of California. Right? That, I mean, they weren't going to sell them, but that was the year. Can you imagine Buckingham Palace being worth that much? Kensington, Chelsea and Westminster apparently are worth more than the whole of Denmark at the moment. So it sounds like brilliant news. But what happened in Japan in about 1990 is they had the most almighty economic crash in history for housing. House prices halved. And they're still at those levels. So it was all illusionary money. It wasn't real. It's only actually worth this much if you can sell it to somebody. All we do at the moment is we sell a tiny fraction of it to people who are willing to carry on paying those prices. But that has to stop at some point, unless you have a new source of money. There's been brilliant work done on long-run series of house prices. It's only been in the last 30 years you've seen this kind of thing go on. My favourite example is the last hegemonic country before us. So the US is now the most powerful country in the world. We were the most powerful country in the world before the US. We had an empire. What was the most powerful country in the world before us? Guesses? We don't teach. Yeah, it was the Netherlands. House prices peaked in Amsterdam in 1675. They then fell in real terms for 300 years.
Has changed though.
Yeah, and Dutch society is now, the Dutch have got over the fact that they were the most powerful country in the world, very nice place to be. You know, there is a bright future ahead. In fact, they've got the tallest children on the planet. But I think part of our problem is that we did have an empire and we're still adjusting to the fact that we're not getting the money we got from the empire. That we never realised we got from the empire. We thought we did it. We thought it was our mills and our shipyards. We just didn't notice the correlation with when India got independence and the countries in Africa got independence and so on, that our economic fortunes appeared to dive down at the same time, which I think fits with that little blip in 1974. But you can't, it's a story. The problem with all of this, as he waves his hands in the air, is what we need is 100 planets. And you can run 100 planets and you can test these things. So we're kind of stuck with a story. But it's, if for some reason we could entice more and more people with lots of money to come here and buy all this property off us, then it would be real money. So we have laws that say you can't come here. Even if you marry somebody, if you don't have enough money, they can't come in, which would be affecting some of your friends at the moment. But you can come in if you're rich. So if we could sell this property to people from abroad, things like that three-bed terrace just down from my house, then it would be real money, and we would have made it. It's only one downside. Our children would have to rent from the people who owned all the houses, or leave the country, because we would no longer own it. So it can only be realised by selling it at these prices. And even then, it's quite hard looking internationally to find who would buy it. A whole set of things came together. One was that the US changed the law with Switzerland to force the Swiss banks to open up their bank accounts. What happened was that when they opened up the bank accounts, they find that they're empty, so that the Americans didn't have to pay tax. Where did the Americans put their money? They bought it in property in London. The Chinese housing market had a crash about a year ago, 9 months before their stock market crash. What did the Chinese investors do who were buying in Shanghai? They bought somewhere that they thought was safer, so they've come to London. George Osborne changes the law to allow you to take all your money out of your pension pot and buy a flat. In fact, all of George Osborne's budgets, all the major changes since 2010, were designed to try to get the housing market to go up as fast as possible in price. Because that's a sensible thing to do if you want to win an election, if you're a Conservative politician. But that's why I think we're heading towards a huge problem. It may look different in different parts of the country. Now, I may be affected by the fact I live in the southeast, but unless you have inherited wealth, if you take a lectureship in my university, you'll be renting. You can't, and you'll stay for a few years and then you leave. And how do you run an institution like that with a set of old people getting older and a group of 25-year-olds turning over at a very high rate, looking really good at the ref, because they're working really hard on their four papers, it's just they're not the same ones in each ref as the ref before.
Hi, Danny, thanks for the talk. The theme I'm interested in from the talk is change. And sort of when you're talking about it, almost the inevitability that you're talking about it with. So it's probably because history's often told backwards, but we very often associate change with big dramatic things like Mexico, student massacres, or I was in Prague last week and a student set himself on fire and down for the government at that point. But it sounds like you're talking about that there's inevitability of this because a generation is going to be disenfranchised with the status quo. Now, I was once talking to sort of changing the status quo with quite glib Scottish person who said to me that why would I change the status quo? What's the future generation ever done for me?
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're saying we don't need to convince people that too much about the future generation, because the future generation is already, like you say, if I will call myself young, me, and I'm quite pissed off already. So it's my vested interest to change things. So are you saying that the ball's already in motion in that sense?
I think the ball's already in motion. I think you can see it in Scotland. Now, if it's just 5.1% of people have voted differently, the pound would have collapsed the next day, because you have a tiny currency based on the small country whose only real asset is some oil, which is in the bit that's just about to go independent. And it was that close. And the moral sentiment has changed in Scotland. It's absolutely changed. The latest poll in August shows the majority would vote for independence if there was a poll now. But it's just changed over how you treat and talk about people there. Now, I think you have to agitate and do that. You know, if you are lethargic, or actually argue that inequality is good, and there are some very powerful people arguing for inequality, that increased inequality would be very beneficial for us, it'll go in the other direction. So I do think there's a big role for advocacy. And I do think if you look at that 1974, 75, 76 period, if you had known in hindsight, and you were around at the time, that was the time to get active. Because if you look at the distribution in France and in Germany, they went in different directions at that point. They voted in different leaders. And it's almost a message in hindsight. You can sit in your armchair eating crisps and watching telly and doing nothing for decade after decade and it won't have much effect. But there are times when things go in different directions, in different places. And that was a time, and it is possibly a time now, just using the very, very crude fact that we are at such a point. You know, you have to go back 100 years to find these levels of inequality again. You have to go all the way to the United States to find a country that's more unequal than us, and it's becoming slightly more equal. We are at an extreme at the moment. So it's probably worth it a bit more than it was in the 80s and 90s in hindsight. You don't know. It's just, this is my best guess at looking at all of this. I don't have a method. I'd love it if somebody could quietly, loudly come out and tell me, is there a better way of doing these kind of things? One great difficulty with this in history is that different countries have different things happening to them. So by far the fastest way to become a more equal country is to take part in a war and to lose it. Because the invading force, the first thing you do when you invade a country is you take the power off the elite, and the way you take the power off the elite is you take their property off them. If you happen to also be a fan of a communist revolution, you do it even more. So when United States troops ended up in Japan in 1945-46, they took the land off the aristocracy. Japan had some of the worst health in the world, and they distributed the land as even as they could amongst the population to create the most equitable country on the planet. The US didn't do this because they wanted to do a lovely social experiment in what happens. What happens is you get the healthiest people on the planet 50 years later. They did it because they were terrified that having dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese, that there would be a communist revolution in Japan as a result. And they wanted to stop that. At a much more mild level, we did the same thing in Germany. We distributed things around the cities. Every city had a function. Can you imagine doing that in Britain? Every city actually has a function. And then, not planned, you bang a wall right through the biggest one that's all powerful. Imagine putting a wall in the middle of London, running halfway through the city, just under the Gherkin. You know, if you actually wanted to get rid of the north-south divide, I'm afraid that, you know, that's the way it happens in other places. So the problem with this story is there are always individual reasons why different countries do different things. But like that story about Singapore and the maids, or why Danish people smoke, you can't be sure your story is right, but there are enough countries to begin to get some patterns. What you really have to do, my colleagues who are more scientific than me say, is you have to produce a series of predictions of what you think will happen if your theories are right, publish them, and then wait another 50 years. But obviously the time to do that is about 10 years before you're about to retire. I'm not quite there yet.
You mentioned about the living wage and people having the living wage but losing benefits. I've heard somebody say that if their employee, they have more employees on the living wage, they'll have to have less employees.
Yeah.
So is the living wage a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, and we have. Every I am getting just more political in my old age, but every Conservative MP voted against the living wage when it first came in. And the number of jobs increased after we brought in the living wage. So having a living wage doesn't mean you get less employment. We almost have too many jobs. We've never had more people working. People have to work. They have no choice. You can't choose not to work for part of the time just to pay for the housing. Nowadays. The £9 an hour is fine. The problem is it's kind of meaningless because it depends entirely what your rent is. So if rent goes up faster in London, and it'll be £9 in London, by the way, not everywhere, yeah, if the rent rises faster than the living wage rises, you're actually going to be on less. It's also a way of them putting in a floor. It's a bit like him saying the Conservatives fought in a factory axe. So you say, we'll make sure the poor are living off no less than £9 an hour. But we're not too worried about the fact that people on £11 an hour aren't going to go up to £14 an hour. Or that nobody's going to get a decent wage, which is about £15 an hour. Whereas the minimum wage in Los Angeles now, they bought a minimum wage in LA. It's a country, any guesses as what it is? It's $15 an hour. But Los Angeles has a minimum wage. You work in a burger joint in Los Angeles, you have to be paid $15. An hour. So we're behind what's possible. For somebody without children, it's a slight increase, apart from, of course, the rent going up and losing the housing benefit. For anybody with kids, the loss in tax credits is so great that we're going down to a new level of falling material position. So it's tragic. On the other hand, if you were interested in the relationship between people's health and their mental health and how they're ranked and they're treated, somebody has set up for you an actual experiment in which you can monitor what's going on. But you have to decide you're going to do that and look at it from the point of view of, let's talk to some families now before it happens, and let's talk to them a year later after they've actually had the cuts. Often people don't know they've had the cuts because the tax credit system is so complicated. They just know they're beginning to get into debt. The census shows you how many people don't know that their council house has been transferred to a housing association. They still fit in the census. I'm living in a council house. in areas where there are no longer any council houses. Many people are just not aware of what's happening to them. They're getting through their everyday lives, and their everyday lives are very, very hard because, you know, people don't buy them a rail ticket and let them swallow up to York to put tickets to people every day. You know, the difference in our lives and home. It was brought home to me when I was teaching in Japan, and I was at a hotel in Japan, and my colleague came to meet me and was having to go to do a lecture, and I said, let's catch a taxi. He just said, no, we don't do that. You only get a taxi if it's an emergency. And it took me back to being a child in 1974, 75, when you only got a taxi then if it was an emergency. The idea that somebody should chauffeur you out after you get on the bus is incredible. So I'm £9 an hour is fine, it's no great achievement. What we need to do is get housing costs down. If you can get housing costs down, that's your rents and the mortgages down, that benefits everybody. It's like every trade union in Britain winning a 2%, 3%, 4% pay rise. But not just for their members, for everybody. So we need to get the cost of living reduced much more than actually increase wages. There's no need to actually increase people's incomes if you can take their costs down. Will landlords manage without all that income? They made 400 billion in the last 5 years, I think, extra profit. No, I think they're not going to take sledgehammers and demolish the houses. And they're also, landlords are not building huge numbers of extra houses to rent. It's not as if it's working as a great economic incentive to do this. So I think the key is to get the costs for people down more than actually getting the wages up. It's also much more achievable to get the costs down at a time when you're becoming poorer as a country, rather than to put the wages up, you need more money coming in somehow. And our last week of getting lots of money in was telling the world that we were the best banker in the world and putting the money with us, looking insane. Our next week is we have the best education system in the world, send your children here, we'll give them a master's degree. Yeah. Maybe that will work for 50 years, or maybe somebody will put a camera up there and record what actually happens in some of these things and what you're getting for your £20,000 a year.
Are you basically saying that things are extremely unequal at the moment, and by regression of the mean that it will over time become more equal, and that the young are getting really pissed off and they will fuel it, fuel the change? Is there anything that we can do to help the young who are presently suffering, as well as all the rest of us, to change? I know what you're suggesting about housing, I understand what you're saying. What else can we do?
I think this is the most likely thing, that if we help it happen. We can explain to the young about student debts. They just, and their parents just, have no idea what it is. You should still go to university. It still makes lots of sense to go to university. You should think about going to university somewhere else in Europe while you still can. Because you get away from home, you learn a new language, and you get no debt. But you do need a bit of money to actually travel and to live. But it's very hard if you work in a university to say, you know, but why university academics are still feeding their own children through this system? Worries me. We need to explain that, you know, you currently pay back at 3% above the rate of inflation, but the Secretary of State can change it at any time without going to Parliament. You are signing up to a debt you have no control over the interest rate of. We need to explain to them that when the debt is defaulted on, we already know that half the students are not going to be, half is already written off, and that's likely to go higher. When it's defaulted on, the default will have to be paid for by the taxpayer. And the taxpayer is going to be those very same students who can't pay the debt, which is partly why you might as well go to university now. Anyway, but at least don't leave people with a lie that this is somehow a sensible loan. You know, what happened in 2010, if you remember, the police got a 20% cut, there were loads of cuts, civil service departments, 30% cuts in jobs. David Willetts, along with his predecessor, Mike Mandelson, rather similar people, they set up the Brown Review with each other. There are 7 members on the Brown Review that got the loan in. The Brown Review comes out saying £9,000 a year. Willits goes to university, Vice Chancellor said, your choice, £9,000 a year, or sack one in four of your staff. That's what happened. That's why we didn't protest against £9,000 a year, because, you know, look left, look right, which one of you is going to go? So university staff kept their jobs, and we tried to forget that we had that, or the people above us had that choice. And the people above us behaved in a completely understandable way. If I, hopefully I'm never going to be a boss at all, but, you know, if I'm in charge of people, I'll do whatever I can not to have to sack them. But we should tell students that this is why it happened. It didn't happen because people working in universities thought this was a really sensible thing, because we were really afraid of losing our livelihoods as well. And so we kicked it down the road. And tell them, there's a paper came out this week saying that Britain and Germany are such different countries. This was written by Nick's Willits's ex-advisor. Nick wrote a paper saying that Britain and Germany are so different, you couldn't possibly have the finance system they have in Germany where you go to university for free, because there's something different about us as people or whatever. These are two Anglo-Saxon countries that are remarkably similar. So I think just explaining things like that, it's painful because they're sitting in universities, sitting in lecture theatres like this, paying more for every lecture they get than you can pay to go to the cinema for the most expensive film that you can see. There's been rather more money spent on producing that film. It's kind of, it's easier for students, I think, to swallow the, you're getting such a wonderful and privileged education, of course it's worth £1,000 a year. But it's not what happens elsewhere. It doesn't happen anywhere else in Europe. Nowhere else charges anything like this. But also nowhere else in Europe do 7% of children go to private schools. It's largely don't exist. We spend a quarter of our money on secondary education on those schools. We're used to it. It's now normal for us, but it's just doesn't happen everywhere. We tend to think all these countries and places are the same, and what's happening here is inevitable and has to happen this way. What happens in the rest of Europe is that people pay higher late tax as soon as they earn €50,000 and above, and you simply tax people more, and you use that the taxation spend to fund these things. And the best effect of higher rate tax is it stops a greedy person being really greedy, because you explain to them, you know, if you're already earning £7 million and you really feel the need to earn another million. I always think of Jeremy Clarkson in this case. Okay, so you're Jeremy Clarkson, you're working quite hard, you're getting a bit old, and somebody says, Jeremy, can you fly to Australia to film a special series about cars for 2 weeks? You're gonna work 12 hours a day, but don't worry, we'll pay you a million, just 2 weeks' work. I think it would really help Jeremy Clarkson if you said to him, of course you can do that, but we're gonna take 95% of that in tax, Jeremy. So you're only going to get £50,000 if you fly to Australia for those 2 weeks. So only fly to Australia for 2 weeks if you really want to. And, you know, higher rate taxes stop greedy people becoming more greedy. They don't actually raise much money, because you get a more equal income distribution, so you raise most from the middle.
I suppose thing is lobbying, and I wondered personally if you ever talked to politicians and if any of them ever listened to you.
the listeners is better too. I used to talk to them more. They used to ask me more, I think. I think they've now sussed out where I am, what I've got to say. The last one I talked to was Oliver Letwin, interestingly, about the big society with that bloke with no hair who went off to California. See? And they thought the meeting didn't go well. They had a billionaire in the room as well opposite me, who was convinced that if you just work hard enough, you too can become a billionaire. But I'm always happy to. I supported three political parties at the last election, which was a big mistake. So I probably won't do that again, unless I'm brave. What happens if you support three political parties is that they all dislike you for your traitorous support of the other two. I supported the National Health Party in Oxford West, I supported Labour in Oxford East, and I supported the Greens in the four rural constituencies in Oxfordshire. And I got no word of thanks at all, because our politics on this side is so tribal, that, and I, it was an education for me.
Saying about housing being something that touches people, that people get hold of if they're thinking about where their kids can live. Or I used to work with young homeless people in the 80s, so all of this housing inevitable crash business, you just feel it rolling towards you, and politically talking about it, and I don't really care because my house prices are rising. So I've moved into health because people care about the NHS, but now we've got the same marketisation, split it off, sell it off, turning into a proper banking industry. Just wonder what your views were about this at the moment, especially as you just mentioned the NHS party.
NHS party, yeah. People do care. That the problem with the NHS is that most people are not using it most of the time. So it's a bit like unemployment, You can do things to it, and it's absolutely terrible for the patients who are using it at that time, but it doesn't affect most people, which is the difference with housing. The privatisation is simply costly. Apart from whatever you believe about better, more ways of running things, the amount of money being wasted by this supposed competition, and the amount of effort by nice doctors who are chairing their CCGs purely to be able to keep the NHS as it is while pretending they're going through the competition, so they're stalling it, but these people who are stalling part of the privatisation could be doing so much more with their time, that in the past these would be medical officers who are making things better, and they're just trying to stop Boots, purchasing another set of GP practice areas or whatever it is. But most, you only tend to think about one thing at a time. Most of you are thinking, I really want to go to the toilet, he's just talking too long, whatever. We only think about one thing at a time. We're not that bothered about most issues. Opinion polling is a bit silly because most people don't have strongly held views on most things. And you can privatise the NHS away slowly and steadily if you want to. The saving grace of all this is for me, is how we created the NHS. We have a particular story of how we created this, and it was an Ivan Bevan and the wonderful Labour Party. But the other story about creating the NHS was that the Second World War cost us so much that the middle class could no longer afford to go to their private doctor anymore. So we had no choice. We were bankrupt, we had to create one. And it's looking similar again.
But that's something I'm reacting to your optimism story, because it sounds like, well, we have to go through the whole horrible crash, until it really gets to people before things change. So we're going to have to see that happen with the NHS as well.
Well, not necessarily. If you take the house price falls, right, it's not an earthquake, right? Nothing will change the houses. When we eventually get the house price falls, there'll be shock horror headlines, month after month after month in Daily Mail. But the houses will still be sitting there. What you need to do is what they did in the States, and in much of the rest of Europe, when they had these house price falls that we didn't get because we had this particular relationship with our houses. You change the laws to say that you cannot be evicted. That happened around the world after 2008. Families can stay in their houses. So, okay, there'll be increased anxiety, but you do practical things, which will be done for hard-working families with children first. But it's not like we've been led to think that this could be terrible. Falls in house prices could be terrible and so on. Or banking crisis could be terrible. It needn't be if it's well managed. And well managed means we partly well managed a crash last time. So there were people who turned white who were there in Washington in that weekend who really thought the cash points were going to stop and could see riots coming. You've only got to feed the cash points with cash. That's a tiny amount of our money. You've got to ensure that people carry on queuing. British people will carry on queuing for an amazing length of time. These things that we think of as disasters are not disasters, it's just we're useless. The disaster is a new flu epidemic. It's a war. It is an actual earthquake. It is a flood that floods into London. There's a whole lot of scenarios that are truly terrible that you can worry about.
But disasters
disasters are also taking away security of tenure, you know, so that people haven't got anywhere to live, and disasters are also deconstructing the health service, you know. So it feels like they're happening, you know, we're seeing them happen.
Yeah.
But it's not until they roll out for, you know, to touch, who is it? I don't know, the children of a particular part of the middle class before there's going to be some sort of reaction.
Yeah, well, I think it's there, it's affecting. It's an argument that what you really want on your side is mum's net. Because it's students protesting about fees is not effective. Mothers of newborn, if you ask mums of newborn babies what's going to happen to their baby, they'll sit with the baby and they'll talk about their university career and what they'll do. It's only about that time a child gets to 15 or 16 that you begin to actually say, oh, they're not going to go to university. And then later, so they're more likely to go to prison. The pressing about it, you can draw maps of where you're more likely to go to prison than to university, but of course you've never showed the maps to any parent in these areas. I think what you want to do is talk about what we could have rather than the way about it. We've only got 2 months of tenure protection as it is. You can't take away much
and
more.
We used to have it. I'm talking about the Thatcherite era. We changed the housing. I was there campaigning against it. It all happened. It all got taken away. We sold off the council housing. We stopped, councils from building. You can see it happening. The same way you can see it happening now with the NHS. And you're talking about it. We're talking about it, campaigning about it. But how many years on are we now? You know. And then we had the crash in 2000. I think, this has got to be it.
Yeah.
This must be the time. You know. Look. I'm getting older.
I know you are. It's like walking up a hill and thinking you've got to the top, and just when you get to the top, you see that the hill's higher. I'm afraid, if you were unlucky, I was born in 1968.
64.
There you go. If you're born then, this is what we have lived through. Okay, that's why. If you've been, my granddad was born in 1916. Not a great time to be born. He was there in the general strike. He had to go and fight in the war. But he had an absolutely charmed life. I mean, politically, look at how things got better. At the very end of his life, he died in his 90s, he phoned me up. He phoned me up to ask whether he was dead. And he was genuinely about it. He said, instead of dying, I said, what's happened? And he had to go in for an operation. He said, they've offered me a choice of what date I want to go in for my operation. He said, this can't be true. He's got nothing else to do. He's in his 90s. He said, have I died? Am I really here? You know, he'd watched things get socially better his entire life to a point where he couldn't believe that you could actually be given a choice for the day you go in for an operation. But it's just because he was born in 1916. We were born at a different time. But on the other hand, you know, you can be positive. Our material conditions of living have been much, much better. We got central heating, we got indoor plumbing, you know, lots of stuff did get better.
State-funded education I got.
Yeah, but the gaps between us have got wider and wider. We could also mix with each other far more. I mean, one of the saddest things for youngsters nowadays, which I mean 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, is you've got to be very careful who you go out with and who you want to be a partner with. Because if they're poor and you are rich, the implications of this for mixing two families together are very tricky. And so you see a reduction in the number of partnerships across social classes now. I mean, so people are being curtailed in the degree to which they can mix and fall in love. And these things are, and they don't realise it. You don't realise there are different sets of nightclubs for different children. The reason for giving the nightclub example, as I was talking about this a few years ago with a pro vice chancellor in Sheffield about how we're not mixing. He said, well, my children mix. They mix in the nightclub. So I then decided to do a little study of the nightclubs and found out that, in fact, Sheffield has segregated nightclubs, the ones the students use and the middle class use, and the ones the working class use. So you don't get mixed. But this is it. This is what's happened as far as an explanation of what's going on. If we'd been in another part of Europe, we wouldn't have seen this. If we'd been in America, it would have been even worse. In America, the middle family became absolutely poor decade on decade. So it's not great, but at least recognise it has happened and it is odd and different. And it almost certainly affects our health in all kinds of ways. most of all, our levels of anxiety and our levels of depression about things, because it just makes you anxious and it's a bit depressing. Right. I'm a geographer, not a clinician. But if you want young people to be less anxious and less depressed, they at least need a vision of the future that could be better. And if you can have a drop in suicide rates of a third just by having a Prime Minister with cufflinks being elected in 1997, the D-ring singing things can only get better. I mean, you really can change. Well, another one, I mean, the biggest drop in suicide rates ever was the drop in suicide rates of the, well, there's drops in wars. People don't kill themselves in war. But the elderly in 1945, 46 and 47, the suicide rate halved in this country. They hadn't got anything. The pensions and the NHS didn't come in until 1948, but they knew it was coming. And you knew you were no longer a burden on your family if you got ill and you were old. You can get an amazingly quick change in the attitude of a population if they think things are going to get better. You get used to what you're living with. People will get angry if they think the degree of unfairness is going to get worse. They think the degree of unfairness they currently have is just normal. What you need to offer people is something which is more fair, and you can get excited about, and then actually begin to deliver it. But we're not Norway. I mean, I always wonder, what the hell do you do in Norway? You know, if you are the country, you know, with the lowest poverty rate since it's been launched, you know, if you are doing so well in so many things, you know, for you, in fact, the default position is probably you're going to slip a bit, because keeping it up at that level will be quite high. More people will vote for a far-right government because they haven't for ages and they've forgotten about it. Something else will occur. For us, it's really easy. You know, if you're the bottom child in the class, we've only got to go and look at almost any other country in the other 25. If you want to know how to do a tenancy agreement, just go and look at the laws on renting in every other country, including in the United States.
The ones we had here a few years ago.
Well, the ones we used to have, but, yeah. There's so many places we can go to look for better ways of doing things. I don't think we necessarily have to be depressed. We have to be depressed about the fact that we don't know that's what we need to do.
I think that's just about us out of time now. So thanks again, Danny, for the talk.